headlines this hour. Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years kicks off, with tens of thousands staging a walkout over pay and jobs. Russia says two American captives will face justice for committing crimes while fighting for the Ukrainian military. Also in the headlines, Palestine's Hamas movement says an imminent dissolution of the Israeli cabinet is proof of its weakness. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Happening now, tens of thousands of railway workers in Britain are walking off their jobs, bringing rail transport nationwide to a standstill. More than 50,000 people are refusing to work in the biggest strike in more than three decades. They are protesting their below-inflation pay. Last-ditch talks over the workers' demands have failed to break the impasse. London's Underground also remains shut. The opposition Labour Party is criticizing Boris Johnson's government for failing to resolve the dispute. The government is under a lot of pressure for its economic policies. In recent months, Britain has been facing high inflation. Train services will also be cancelled on Thursday and on Saturday. Strike leaders say the campaign will run for as long as necessary, and there are fears of similar industrial action among teachers, medics, and waste disposal workers. Bladen police say tens of thousands of people took part in a march through Brussels on Monday, demanding government measures to offset record high inflation. This is while the European Union comes under mounting pressure for spending billions of euros on arming Ukraine, at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling to make ends meet. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day. Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up. And the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike.
Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike. Trains, trams, metros and buses are not operating. All of the departing flights from the main airports in Zaventem and Charleroi have been cancelled, impacting an enormous number of passengers, including would-be holidaymakers.
Western nations are sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro. Those on strike insist there is too much emphasis on war and not enough on diplomatic negotiations.
There is a NATO rule which says that each country has to invest 2% of their budget on military stuff. I think this is completely useless.
They have money to send to Ukraine for sophisticated weapons. It will cost a lot. And they say they don't have enough money to support us.
All of them, they just have blood on their hands. I think that's the real problem. And high society who is just making profit of all of that.
Unions in Belgium are warning of more strikes during the summer if the national government and EU authorities fail to ease cost-of-living pressures. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Kremlin says two Americans who were caught fighting Russian forces in Ukraine have committed crimes and will have to be punished for that. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the two were endangering Russian lives by firing at and shelling military personnel. According to Peskov, Russia cannot guarantee that they will not face the death penalty. He says the nature of their crimes will be investigated. These are the first official comments coming out of Moscow about the two Americans after the U.S. State Department said that it had seen reports of their seizure. Both captives are reportedly U.S. military veterans. Earlier, a Russian-backed court sentenced two Britons to death for fighting as mercenaries alongside the Ukrainian army. A top Russian official says holding nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. is pointless, suggesting that Moscow should wait until Americans come forth and beg for negotiations. The former president and current deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, believes that there is no need to negotiate nuclear disarmament with the U.S. yet, because it is bad for Russia. Medvedev says that Washington and Moscow do not have any relations now, and therefore everything is, in his own words, a dead zone. As Russia's president, Medvedev signed the New START Treaty in 2010 with then-U.S. President Barack Obama. The treaty was extended in 2021 for 5 years, but fears of a renewed arms race are now in the rise amid critically sour relations over the war in Ukraine. Russia and the U.S. are the world's biggest nuclear powers. They control about 90% of the global atomic arsenal. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas welcomes the imminent collapse of the Israeli cabinet, saying that it shows how weak and how shaky the regime is. Spokesman Fawzi Barhoum says the development is also a sign of Palestinian steadfastness and the power of the resistance to confuse Israeli officials and to thwart their goals. Leaders of Israel's fragile coalition cabinet have revealed that they will submit a bill to dissolve parliament next week. They say that all other options to keep the cabinet have failed. This means that Israel is heading towards its fifth general elections in 3 years. That will effectively make Naftali Bennett the regime's shortest-serving prime minister ever. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent joining us from Gaza City. Ashraf, tell us more about what Fawzi Barhoum, a Hamas spokesperson, has said about this collapse of the Israeli cabinet.
Yes, Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum talked about the failing Israeli government, especially this one. He described it as shaky and weak, and Hamas has long attributed the failures of Israeli cabinets and governments to its defeats and confrontations with the Palestinian resistance. For example, this morning, another Hamas spokesman, Hazem Qasem, was speaking to the Al-Aqsa radio, and he said that the main reason for the failure of the current Israeli government is what happened in November 2018 during the operation of the Edge of the Sword, and he was referring to special forces trying to enter the southern part of Khan Yunis, and they were confronted by Hamas fighters, killing a top Israeli military commander, and that led to the resignation of at the time Israeli Army Minister Avigdor Lieberman. So during the last 3 years, five Israeli government has been changed, and and there's going to be elections in October. Qasem also said that the fact that the Israeli regime is weak and shaky should be send a very strong message to those Arab regimes who have been normalizing ties with Israel, because he said that Israel is a weak regime and no one should deal with it, and that instead that Arab leaders and Arab regimes should strengthen their ties with Hamas and the Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, and that's a good point that you make there. I mean, we are looking obviously at the resistance and Palestinians' steadfastness, as you said, Ashraf, to be one of the reasons perhaps that this cabinet has collapsed, because obviously if there were policies that were working, maybe this wouldn't be the case. Are we looking at a reemergence, do you know, of any kind, a reemergence of Netanyahu again on the scene of Israel?
Well, it is possible. The Israeli society is very extremist, and they tend to lean towards the right. So it's highly possible that Netanyahu could return to the political arena as a prime minister. He was the longest serving prime minister within the Israeli regime since establishment in 1948, and he's very popular despite the fact that he is corrupt. And when you see a society that chooses corrupt officials, it shows you what kind of society are we dealing with.
Thank you for that. Ashraf Shannon from Gaza City, many thanks. Iran slams Israel's, quote, outrageous allegations against the country, saying that the regime wants to deflect attention from its atrocities in the region. Iran's UN ambassador says that Israel is infamous for its racist policies and hate speech and cannot hide this fact through propaganda. Majita Taravanchi was responding to anti-Iran allegations by Israel's representative at a UN meeting marking the first international day for countering hate speech. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian envoy warned against the growing trend of Islamophobia, saying that such tendencies lead to violent extremism and threaten the security of all societies. He cited the politicization and restriction of the hijab, the burning of the Holy Quran, and the desecration of Islamic symbols and holy sites in some countries. Tahta Ravanchi blamed this situation on anti-Muslim media outlets and civic groups promoting Islamophobia in the West. He also lamented the lack of resolve on the part of certain governments to confront hate speech and acts of hate against Muslims. Also, in another address to the UN Security Council, Iran's envoy condemned Israel's continued attacks on Syrian civilians and infrastructure, particularly the recent strike on Damascus International Airport. Iran's UN ambassador described Israeli attacks on Syria as malign and an act of terrorism. Majid Tahta Ravanchi said Israel's raids violate international law and Syria's sovereignty while jeopardizing regional stability and security. Expressing Iran's support for Syria, the envoy said Damascus has a legitimate right to defend itself in line with international law and the UN Charter. The Iranian envoy also called on the UN Security Council to abandon its double standards by unequivocally condemning the repeated Israeli aggressions and holding the regime accountable. Syrian air defenses have succeeded in intercepting the majority of missiles fired by Israeli aircraft, although they still cause material damage and casualties. Damascus says the Israeli attacks are carried out in support of terrorist groups in the Arab country. Last week, Russia summoned Israel's ambassador over recent airstrikes against Damascus International Airport. Lebanese are still suffering from the consequences of the Saudi-led war on their country, despite the UN truce entering its third month. Abdul Latif al-Washali has the story.
Amid a decline in military operations since the UN ceasefire took effect in April, the number of victims of banned weapons in Yemen keeps rising. Remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are taking more lives as Riyadh refuses to allow badly needed equipment, including mine detectors, to enter the war-torn country. Yemen's Mine Action Center reported 120 cases since the start of the truce, 26 of them in the first third of June.
Since the beginning of this year, 326 people have fallen victim to leftover cluster bombs. 120 of them alone have been killed since the start of the truce. The bombings of the Saudi-led coalition continue to claim the lives of innocent citizens on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of necessary equipment for years, even though our work is for humanitarian purposes. Therefore, we believe that the coalition seeks to kill civilians even after the end of the war.
The Mine Action Center says the Saudi-led coalition has prevented the entry of mine detectors to Sana'a since 2018 for no good reason, and field teams are still working despite all the risks.
The biggest problem that the center faces is the lack of mine detectors and field equipment. We have been facing this problem since the outset, and unfortunately, the devices and personal protection equipment were not provided even throughout the years of war. In 2018, the United Nations informed us that our equipment had arrived in Djibouti, but much to our surprise, part of it was held by the Saudi-led coalition and some was handed over to other parties not affiliated with us, and we have not received anything until this moment.
During the seven-year war, the Saudi-led coalition has used 15 types of internationally prohibited cluster bombs in its attacks against residential areas across Yemen. However, officials say relevant international organizations refrain from cooperating for political reasons. People here are dying due to the remnants of internationally banned weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition. Experts believe the number of victims will continue to rise unless the coalition allows the needed equipment to defuse the weapons that kill Yemeni women and the children to enter Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the Saudi city of Medina after years of longing for a trip to the land of revelation. Before going to the holy city of Mecca, the pilgrims visit the Prophet Muhammad's mosque and other holy sites in the city of Medina. Mahdi Abbasian has more.
shedding tears of joy after years of longing for the chance to visit a land described as the land of revelation in the Holy Quran. Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, or the city of the Prophet, as it hosts the final resting place of the Prophet Muhammad. Direct flights from Iran arrive in Saudi cities of Medina and Jeddah and will continue until 4th of July. A large number of Iranian pilgrims will first stay in Medina for 6 days and five nights to visit the Prophet's mosque and the Baqi Cemetery, among other sites, before leaving for Mecca to perform the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
Being in a place that the Holy Prophet Muhammad and her daughter Lady Fatima, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein had been is an amazing spiritual experience.
I've been to lots of holy shrines, but here I feel different. I feel absolute peace and detached from the world.
The outbreak of the coronavirus limited trips to Mecca and Medina for 2 years, with only a limited number of Saudi pilgrims being allowed to perform it over the period. Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, while many of them have been awaiting for as long as 15 years. Going around the Prophet's mosque, you can see Iranians overwhelmed with emotions, most of them describing their visit to Medina as a unique experience. In 2019, the last Hajj before the outbreak of the coronavirus, about 85,000 Iranian pilgrims visited Saudi Arabia. But this year, with the reduction of quotas in Islamic countries, nearly 40,000 people from Iran are allowed to participate in the annual event.
Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, and many more are on their way to get to this holy city. This is while many more Iranians, thousands, have to wait for at least another year so that they maybe get the chance to visit this holy city once in their life. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Today, arrogant France grandeur is broken and nations talk against the US. February 17, 2022. One hears from some individuals that the revolution has strayed from its goals. This is not the case. If the country has strayed from the goals of the revolution, the enemies of the revolution would not have been so hostile to the system. The Islamic Republic and Islamic Iran. These hostilities themselves are a sign that the country and the Islamic Republic have been loyal and committed to these goals. One hears some people say that the system has strayed from the goals of the revolution and they want to show that they are committed to the revolution. I do not agree with this statement, nor do I believe their attachment to the revolution. One who pursues an aristocratic lifestyle and whose path is an aristocratic one, cannot believe in the slogan of supporting the barefooted. The slogan of the revolution is the slogan of supporting the oppressed and the barefooted. The people who seek an aristocratic lifestyle and whose movement is in an aristocratic movement cannot be faithful to this slogan. The slogan of the revolution is confrontation with arrogance and with the arrogant movement and with arrogant powers.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Those who speak about surrendering to arrogance and to the U.S. cannot be committed to this revolution and these goals. This is not an acceptable comment. And we thank God for bestowing the blessing on the Iranian nation to be resistant. The people endured, showed resistance, and were able to bring the country to this point. And God willing, this perseverance must continue. On a daily basis, not only inside the country, but also in the region, the endurance of the Iranian nation is influential. Today, as you can see, the resistance movement in the countries of the region is growing, and America's power has been broken in the region. Nations have become bold and are speaking against the United States and against their moves. Well, we must appreciate this and continue the movement of the revolution. My recommendation to our dear youth is to see today in which line the enemy is moving, what the enemy is aiming, and then to act and move in the opposite direction. In my opinion, the way I see things, the enemy has targeted the nation, public opinion, and the minds of the young people. They are spending billions of dollars in their think tanks, as they themselves put it, think tank and research circles, trying to turn the Iranian nation, and especially the youth, from this path.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has lambasted the West, stressing that the so-called golden billion countries still pretend that they are superior and consider other countries to be their colonies. He, however, stated that the West's ruling elites live in a dream world and refuse to see global changes. Putin also accused Western countries of deliberately undermining the foundations of international order to satisfy their geopolitical illusions.
I think Putin's legacy will be in ushering in the end of American hegemony and the start of a unipolar world, helped in no small part by President Xi Jinping of China. The end of American hegemony will be mourned by a very small clique of nations that call themselves the international community. In reality, the international community is America and its client states. China, Russia, India, and much of the Islamic world don't take part in the shared narrative that is suggested by the term of the international community.
The Russian president stated that over the past decades, new powerful centers have been formed on the planet and are growing. He added that each of these countries has developed its own systems, and also stressed that they have the right to protect themselves to ensure their national sovereignty.
It's obvious that the rules, the essence of the new world order, will be set by strong sovereign states which do not move along the trajectory drawn by somebody else. Only strong sovereign states can say their word in this emerging world order. Otherwise, they're doomed to become or remain rightless colonies.
Moreover, the Russian president said that the European Union has completely lost its political sovereignty, and its bureaucratic elites are dancing to someone else's tune, accepting whatever they're told from above, causing harm to their population and their economy. Putin slammed the EU's decision to impose sanctions on Russia as not well thought out, stating that the bloc's policies have delivered a serious blow to their own economies. The Russian leader says Western nations sought to use sanctions to crush the Russian economy by destroying logistics chains and hitting the Russian industry, finance, and living standards, but they failed to accomplish their goals. He added that the move has boomeranged, exacerbating the social and economic crisis across the West, especially in Europe.
Well, American imperialism has never been very good at seeing two steps in front of itself. Due to the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, they've actually hurt themselves equally, if not more, than they have Russia. Since these sanctions have been imposed on Russia, Russia has managed to earn over 100 billion in fossil fuel exports. The ruble has now bounced back to be 30% stronger than it was at the beginning of the year compared to the dollar. And these sanctions that America have imposed have caused a fuel crisis all over the world. This has caused huge problems as a detrimental effect on the agriculture of the world, which is now risking a food crisis.
In light of the West sanctions and the move backfiring, the US and many countries in Europe are experiencing record high inflations. Hence, the move has led to the average citizen paying the price of what Putin called decisions divorced from reality and taken contrary to common sense. Apart from inflations as high as 20%, the EU could also lose billions of dollars as a direct result of the sanctions. Moreover, the West policies and sanctions also seem to be responsible for worsening global food insecurity, as they're hindering many nations' attempts of helping those in need. In his speech, Putin noted that the sanctions on Russia, particularly those on fertilizer and grain, have stopped the country's exports and are one of the reasons for the global food insecurity. He also warned that if there is famine in the world's poorest countries, it will be entirely on the conscience of the US administration and the European bureaucracy. The US has so far led a foreign policy that is mainly comprised of hostile approaches against any nation that doesn't play by its rules. And the West not allowing for aid exports from Russia is only another example of its controversial policies. These hostile policies are clearly demonstrated by the US's rising tensions with China, which followed Washington's adventurism in Taiwan. Russia, which was faced with sanctions after Moscow followed the country's national interests, and Iran, which is subject to Washington's economic warfare. The US-led moves have, however, only resulted in target nations prospering and becoming stronger under the failed Western policies.
A new report by the Wall Street Journal reveals that Israel secretly coordinates with the U.S. on many of the airstrikes it carries out in Syria. The report adds that since 2017, Israel has carried out more than 400 airstrikes in Syria and other parts of the West Asia region. It claims that Israeli attacks have been aimed at restricting Iran and its allied forces in Syria. The vast majority of those Israeli airstrikes have been approved by the U.S. Central Command and at the Pentagon. The U.S. aims to ensure that Israel's bombing raids don't interfere with the U.S.-led military campaign in Syria. Many observers believe that the revelation by the Wall Street Journal was rather a confirmation of an open secret policy.
I think, first of all, whenever anyone says that the U.S. is secretly doing this or that with Israel, it's almost naive to say that. Israel is, in essence, an agent of the United States. I know there are people that think it works the other way around, but Israel is a Euro-American white settler state that was imposed on Palestine, as people know. Project beginning, I guess, perhaps you say, from the Balfour Declaration in the 20s forward to when the state of Israel, quote unquote, was created. And it's been a military base, basically, from which to secure the oil fields of the area, Iran's, Iraq's, all of it, Syria's, everywhere. The Israeli military, for all of its public relations effort to the contrary, is an agent of the U.S. military, with some nominal French and British input into that. Certainly financial input is not nominal, it's real. But this is a creature of the Pentagon and Langley that behaves in coordination with the policy that is implemented by the United States.
The timing of the Wall Street Journal revelation comes as the Israeli regime has increased its attacks against Syria. Last week, the regime heavily struck Damascus International Airport, which is still not completely up and running. Syrian officials have said on many occasions that U.S. troops in Syria are there to loot the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was not embarrassed to frankly say that he kept U.S. troops in Syria for Syrian oil only.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and
the fight against Daesh seems to have been a good pretext to maintain U.S. illegal presence in Syria. Syrian officials have also repeatedly called on the United Nations to stop Israel's strikes on the country, but those calls have almost always gone unnoticed behind a couple of verbal admonitions by UN officials. This seems to have emboldened the regime to carry on its attacks with impunity.
After setting loose Daesh and Al-Qaeda and 47 other varieties of jihadi on Syria, the U.S. government found itself facing a request from the Syrian government that had, by the way, been twice elected since 2011 by vast majorities of Syrians inside and outside the country. Israel is, you know, a U.S. lapdog. That has lots of advanced weapons. It's a money laundry for money that goes funneled through the Pentagon and Langley. Billions and billions of dollars of money taken from American taxpayers ends up in the hands of arms merchants, all kinds of people through Israel and whatever. And these things are used to inflict misery on the people of the Middle East to the extent that there's any resistance between these people that want to own the resources of that area and the actual ownership of it.
The confirmations of the U.S. approval and coordinations of Israeli attacks in Syria can definitely be seen as rather a public support for regime strikes in Syria, especially at a time when Israel has increased the intensity of its cross-border attacks. Such support would likely embolden the Israeli regime to carry out more attacks in Syria.
Turkey has targeted northern Iraq, killing several people and injuring a number of others. The strike hit the Sinjar Resisting Units, or YBS, a militia affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in Iraq's northern province of Sinjar. Turkey regards the PKK as a terrorist outfit. According to security sources, the strike hit a municipal council building in Snani, a village near the border with Syria. Turkey regularly carries out airstrikes into northern Iraq and has sent commandos to support its offensives. Baghdad accuses Turkey of violating its sovereignty. Turkey has a long-running military campaign in northern Syria against Syrian Kurdish YPG militia. Ankara considers that group as a terrorist organization as well. Ankara is reportedly planning to expand its military operation in northern Syria. President Erdogan has told the parliament Ankara aims to resume its efforts to create a 30-kilometer safe zone along its border with Syria. He has also urged NATO member states to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria.
It is crazy to think that the Turks will be fighting American-sponsored groups, and there isn't anybody in the world community that can call them up on the hypocrisy and say, you are fighting amongst yourselves in a way that could end up in a world war.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the international community not to work with Erdogan on the lands of other countries to achieve goals that will have catastrophic effects on security, peace, and stability in the region and in the world. Russia also considers Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise as it could escalate and destabilize the situation. Iran also voiced concern about the planned operation, saying the move could complicate the situation even further. In Syria, Turkey conducted three military operations in 2016, 2018, and 2019 that specifically aimed to prevent the formation of politically autonomous regions along the Turkish border controlled by Kurdish-dominated YPG militants. A fourth operation in 2020 in the Idlib region did not specifically target PKK affiliates, but it was in line with Turkey's desire to maintain territorial control and create a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border.
But it's a big problem. It shows Turkey up for what it is, and that Turkey is doing everything in the region purely for their own short-term benefit, and they are quite happy to fight the Kurds and crush the Kurds, and this completely conflicts with the the Americans aren't really trying to help the Kurds, as they aren't ever really trying to help anyone apart from themselves, and their short-term allies, the Kurds, are going to end up fighting their other allies, the Turks.
Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019 after Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push YPG fighters away from border areas. Turkey has played a major role in supporting terrorists in Syria ever since a major foreign-backed insurgency overtook the country more than 10 years ago. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other senior officials have said the Damascus government will respond through all legitimate means available to the ongoing ground offensive by Turkish forces and allied Takfiri militants in the northern part of the war-battered Arab country.
Iran is expanding its diplomatic and economic ties with its neighbors and beyond. On Wednesday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi hosted his Turkmen counterpart Serdar Berdimuhamedov in Saadabad Palace in northern Tehran. Iran and Turkmenistan signed a set of documents and memoranda of understanding to broaden bilateral cooperation in different fields. 9 MOUs were signed in the meeting to boost cooperation in various fields, including politics, economy, trade, transportation, investment, new technologies, environment, sports, energy, judiciary, education, research and tourism. This is Berdimuhamedow's first visit to Iran as Turkmenistan's president. He traveled to Tehran in January as the special envoy of Turkmenistan's former president and held talks with Raisi. Iran and Turkmenistan have agreed to set up a major trade center that can facilitate ties between businesses in the two countries amid efforts to deepen economic relations between the two neighbors. The establishment of the Tehran-Ashgabat Trade Center was discussed on Tuesday during a meeting between Iranian Trade Minister Reza Fatemi Amin and Deputy Head of the Cabinet of Ministers of Turkmenistan, Batir Atdayev. On Tuesday, Iran's president hosted visiting Pakistani Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. During the meeting, Raisi hailed ties between Iran and Pakistan and said Tehran and Islamabad can expand their bilateral trade and business ties to benefit both nations.
I find this most recent flurry of diplomatic activity and state visits to Iran to be highly significant. What this signifies is that clearly Iran, far from being isolated on the world stage, is in fact extending its ties, bilateral ties, both regionally and as well ties to Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere.
And earlier in the week, Iran welcomed Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and his high-level delegation. Iran and Venezuela have signed partnership agreements in the fields of science, technology, agriculture, oil and gas, petrochemicals, tourism, as well as culture. Raisi hailed the accord as an indication of the two countries' determination to expand bilateral ties despite U.S. and Western pressure. And the Venezuelan president, for his part, lauded the 20-year partnership agreement between Tehran and Caracas, saying the two sides will be able to expand bilateral relationship by consolidating their ties and drawing a clear vision in the next two decades.
As far as the outcome of these visits, this can only be positive for these nations, for most recently Pakistan, whose prime minister visited, for the Turkmen president, and as well for President Maduro. Those nations and national leadership that seeks to maintain sovereignty and independence, especially and particularly from American global economic and military hegemony, will greatly benefit their national economies as well as their populations.
And last month, Iran hosted Tajikistan's President Emomali Rahman. That visit also resulted in the signing of major deals between Tehran and Dushanbe. Since the inauguration of President Raisi's government, Tehran has stressed on the expansion of ties with regional as well as non-regional countries. Raisi's major achievement was his attendance at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Dushanbe, where Iran was formally accepted as a new member of the organization. Iran's accession to the SCO will be a major boost to the bloc's influence in the region.
I believe what we're seeing is the relatively exciting and promising, although challenging, beginnings of the complete break from the dollar-based global economic system. I say exciting and promising because this will definitely enable nations that seek to maintain their independence and sovereignty to break from the dollar-based global economic system. However, this is certainly not an easy task and one that comes without costs.
Mainly because Iran's massive transportation network can facilitate regional and international trade. Iran is also expected to benefit economically from the membership in the bloc. The Iranian Customs Office said that Iranian exports to SCO members had increased by 41% year-on-year in the 11 months to late February, reaching nearly $18.3 billion.
But ultimately, we can look forward to the development of actual systems and structures that will enable nations, independent sovereign nations such as Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, potentially other nations in the region who want to get on board, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, which we were recently talking about, to move towards a system that is not reliant, for example, on SWIFT, and that completely bypasses the dollar.
Earlier this year, Iran's president also visited Russia to expand bilateral ties. Tehran and Moscow reached agreements to expand their cooperation in the fields of industry, defense and aerospace sectors, as well as oil and energy. The burgeoning ties between Iran and other countries have foiled plots by the U.S. and its allies to isolate Iran. They also show that sanctions and threats have failed to stop Iran's progress.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing
our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام والله لدنياكم هذه أهون في عيني من عراق خنزير في يد مجزوم.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "By Allah, this world of yours is more lowly in my view than the leftover bone of a pig in the hand of a leper."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, has spoken about this concept and this metaphorical heart, this center of love and emotion within ourselves, this heart which is sometimes easily swayed by the waves and the tides of this ocean called life. Of course, when we look at Imam Ali alayhi salam, he had complete control over his heart, and he had perfected and purified his heart, for he was truly the living miracle of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we have talked in various sessions about this heart that Imam Ali alayhi salam has talked about in its various facets and in its various aspects. In this last program, which deals with this aspect of the heart that the Commander of the Faithful spoke about, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Therefore, every failure or shortage will harm the heart, and every excess will corrupt the heart." And so here, dear friends, we find truly what a beautiful lesson, that failures and shortcomings on our behalf will harm our heart. And is this not true? And on the other hand, any kind of excess will corrupt the heart. So, dear friends, we have to be very careful and try our best to keep this heart in balance. Neither let it become distressed because of things like poverty or things like faults and shortcomings, which occur every now and then, despite our tries and efforts for these shortcomings and flaws to not come about. And likewise, on the other hand, if we have an excess perhaps in wealth or an excess in something that is negative or something that is not recommended by Islam, excess, of course, will corrupt the heart. It is interesting, but when we talk about this excess that will corrupt the heart, it is almost like the example of giving a child too much candy to eat. The more sweets they eat, the excess that they have, the more corrupted become their teeth and their gums and their overall health. And so in the beautiful words of Imam Ali alayhi salam, shortages will harm and shortcomings will harm your heart, and excesses will corrupt it. So save your heart from both of these extremes. Another beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali
عليه السلام.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRive English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاجعل نفسي مطمئنة بقدرك راضية بقضائك.
Oh Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
What is the history of the shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam? The commander of the faithful instructed his sons to bury him at this location here. We have narrations from the Prophet of Islam Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam highlighting the burial place of Imam Ali alayhi salam to be at this particular location. Imam Ali told his sons that he will be buried next to two other prophets, Prophet Adam and Prophet Nuh, peace be upon them. It was the night of the 21st of Ramadan, 40 after Hijrah. The sons of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam al-Hassan, peace be upon him, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, Muhammad ibn al-Halafiyya, as well as the Imam's cousin, Abdullah ibn Ja'far, buried Imam Ali alayhi salam secretly and concealed the grave. Why was the grave of Imam Ali alayhi salam concealed? Well, the reason is outlined by a number of scholars, such as Sheikh Ibn Tawus. He says the concealment of the grave and its location was due to the fear of the enemies, like the Umayyads and the Kharijites. This is because it was possible that they would try to find his grave and exhume his body, which would have inevitably led to a conflict with the Bani Hashim tribe. Through this, several people would be killed, and it would cause a large fitna, conflict in the Muslim community. The Imam alayhi salam was extremely concerned with the well-being of the Muslim nation during his lifetime and made constant effort to extinguish the fire of fitna. As such,
It was to be expected that he would encourage the same line of thought and actions that he embodied throughout his life to continue after his death, and that he would want his family and his followers to abandon what could be a source of conflict. During this period of time that the grave was hidden, it was visible